The next case, 97-998, State of Ohio versus Brian Androsky.
Good morning. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, Mr. Yellow, Mr. Hewitt. May I please the court, my name is Glenda J. Gelman, I represent the State of Ohio and its prosecution of Brian Androsky. On Friday, February 24th of 1996, the defense attorney wrote down the SG rank of their house and filed a car with the field of buddies, dead down to the OSU campus area. On his way out at 3:15, he drove in a manner I tend to call a high-speed slalom. I don't know whether it's ever going to be an Olympic event, but he was constantly cutting in and out of traffic, rapidly braking to avoid colliding with other vehicles, nearly side-swiping other vehicles, and not signaling any. All of this at a speed approaching 100 miles an hour. One of the cars that he nearly sideswiped happened to contain
Could you clarify a point? I was always under the assumption that there are only two ways to make a traffic violation stop. One would be citizen's arrest. The citizen sees a traffic violation, file a complaint about it. And the other is under 4549.13, where the officer must be in uniform and in a marked vehicle. Am I incorrect in that, or are there, which you're going to address, I'm sure, no one has addressed 4549.13, and I thought that that was a given, that you had to be in a uniform and in a marked vehicle.
The application of that, to answer the first part of your question, it is exceedingly rare for a citizen to come in and be able to file a traffic complaint, uniform traffic ticket from
We have a mayor in Toledo that has numerous occasions.
I can tell you it doesn't happen much in Columbus, although I have a few times I've been attempted to get all the uniform traffic tickets I've done. At any rate, the other question regarding markers or uniform, that tends to just be an issue for what testimony is competent at trial. Those two statutes dealing with markers or uniform are also reflected in the evidence rules that say you must be a markers or uniform. Pretty much the genesis behind that was in order to prevent speed traps where you have an officer and a markers are sitting by a billboard waiting for somebody to come by.
Or at night if you stop by a vehicle and you're fearful that it's not a police officer.
Right, and that's the other consideration is the fear of people. In this case, these officers
are not Is that what the statute says? It seemed to me you told us what the practice is, not what the statute is. Justice Redmond asked you what the statute provides.
Well, I think there is some question of whether the statute saw its continuing validity after that became an issue for the evidence rules, because it's an issue of whether its procedure or substantive right at that point. I know that they kept the statute on the books, but more often than not, this is assessed as an evidentiary question on whether the testimony is competent because the officer wasn't in the marked prison uniform. In the instant matter, the officers did not use their car to pull this person over, so I don't think that the marked cruiser issue would have any bearing whatsoever on the fact. As well, once they came up and they immediately displayed their badges and identified themselves as whatever control enforcement agents. It's pretty unusual for these kind of circumstances to ever happen, but at most, I don't know that they. It was a seizure of the Fourth Amendment. I don't know whether I would call it a necessarily traffic stop because they didn't actively stop the vehicle. They came up, approached him, identified themselves, and detained him.
But they didn't have the authority to do that.
I think that's still open to question, Your Honor. The lower court determined that It didn't matter whether they were there or not without the statute.
I don't care what the lower court said. I'm saying that they did not have the authority to do what they did.
Well, under the emergency assistance provision, I think it's very arguable that these individuals have some authority to operate under those circumstances.
Emergency.
I wasn't on 315-98. I think I would have called it an emergency.
The what? The emergency what?
There is an emergency assistance provision that allows liquor control enforcement officers to render assistance to another law enforcement official, either at the request or in the case of an emergency.
Which doesn't fit this situation at all.
Well, the at the request doesn't fit the situation at all. And there has been absolutely no factual finding one way or the other by either court that this was not an emergency.
Well, there's some confusion in my reading that someone told them to stop this car. Is there a pretty clear indication that they were told to stop the car?
There's testimony from the officers themselves. What the circumstances that happened, these individuals were, you know, the only car apparently on the freeway that actually had a direct line to another law enforcement agency through what's called the LEARN Network, which is run by the Ohio State Highway Patrol, monitored by them, and it's a way for other officers from different communities to be able to communicate one with the other through a relay through LEARN. These officers, or the, I guess I'll call them agents so we don't get confused, the liquor control agents apparently did not realize that some folks might say, this has to be direct, and I think that's probably best. Well, they do tend to have precise rules, but those rules also differ depending on what judge you're in front of them. Some judges would say that you have to comply with that absolute letter. Some judges would say, okay, I'm going to look at this and determine whether their actions were reasonable, which is exactly why we're here today, because there is such a variation among applications. Now, I can't say that happens technically under the statute that we're here about, because it's not been determined that much, but as far as 2935-3, talking about fresh pursuit, and when you can arrest without a warrant, there are myriad interpretations on that and what constitutes pursuit within your own jurisdiction.
If this had been an off-duty policeman in his or her own private vehicle following this driver down 315, would that off-duty policeman in his or her private car had the right to stop this person?
They can't use the vehicle to pull them over. Our position tends to be...
Well, pull them over makes it a stop, doesn't it? Pulling them over makes it a stop.
Well, they use the vehicle to pull them over. I think that's definitely a stop. I think that under these circumstances, when you approach the vehicle, display that as an issue of authority, then at that point is an attention that I really have a hard time calling it a stop of that car.
All I want to know is an off-duty patrol person can stop somebody under these circumstances in the middle of the night, in a private car?
I think that they could do the same thing that these officers did. I think you'd have a hard time justifying them using their private vehicle, flashing lights, waving at them or whatever, in order to get them pulled over. That is exactly the type of thing that the statute doesn't threaten.
Hopefully their private vehicle wouldn't have flashing lights on it.
Flashing their headlights or using something else. Because in this day and age, you never know why someone's doing that. And there's a legitimate fear on the part of the individual that someone would attempt to pull over in that manner. That this isn't a law enforcement authority. They would have no reason to believe that. Under these circumstances, we're simply not presented with that. But to answer Justice Douglas' question, I think that an off-duty police officer, if they saw that this individual was endangering that many people, was able to contact radio and say, you know, where's the cruiser? He stops on his own, and I can detain him here. All that together adds up to a pretty reasonable officer.
Well, I ask because the rule is that even when you're off-duty as a police officer, you're on-duty. I know in Toledo we even required police officers to carry their gun
right
24 hours a day when they were out.
So you're
all right. So you're conceding, are you, that it would not have been a proper stop for an off-duty officer?
No, I'm not saying under the statute would have been proper. I think it would be improper if he used his private vehicle.
Well, that's a set of facts. This looks like a private vehicle with the liquor agents in it. I mean, you know what kind of cars they drive, and I do, and they sure look like private vehicles. Now, would an off-duty police officer have had the right to stop? And if you say no, then ergo these people who are not off-duty police officers don't have the right. I thought you'd argue, yeah, a police officer does have that right.
I think they do, but I think you have a problem when you have the pullover as opposed to the vehicle already stopped at an intersection.
Well, how do you stop without pulling over?
No. Say you make the vehicle pull over as opposed to an individual that's already stopped on their own volition.
Okay.
And approach the car and show that. I think that those facts are very distinguishable. And we have cases where all city officers have complied that way because they've been marking to a marked cruiser their own stature, and the individual was going to either leave the jurisdiction or basically get away, or, you know, it's the safer way to pull them over.
Let me risk of beating this issue to death. 61D, the trial court said that doesn't apply, and this is the call for help, and the court of appeals, I guess, wasn't appealed. Why does 61D not apply? Is it because the police officers, the real police officers, were not there at the scene asking for help? Is it because the...
Well, that's an odd procedural posture for the case, Justice Moyer. What happened at the trial court level was the trial court said, I'm just going to assume that the statute was violated for purposes of this argument because I find it makes absolutely no difference. I'm not going to base a suppression hearing or a suppression motion or a ruling on a non-constitutional violation. This is a statutory violation, non-constitutional. So even if it were violated, I'm not making factual findings one way or the other. They assumed that for purposes of argument because it made no difference to their determination. Once we got to the Court of Appeals made the broad statement that this just wasn't within 61. So no court has ever made a valid finding on whether this was within those emergency assistance provisions.
Yeah.
And so that's another part of the problem. In my opinion, it probably should have been remanded to the trial court for finding out whether it did come within 61 if that was going to be a valid consideration for suppression.
Are you saying that there's no sanction necessary in the activities in this case?
I don't think that's at this point for me to say. I think that that statute does not apply the sanction of suppression.
Well, you're saying that
it's not automatic.
You're saying that the suppression of the evidence should not be a sanction here.
That's correct.
Is that correct? All right. Now, is there any lesser sanction that should be used here?
Well, I think then you talk about civil liability.
So you're talking about no sanction whatsoever?
Not within the context of the criminal case. If you're going to sanction the officer for by way of suppression, the U.S. Supreme Court has said again and again, the whole point of the exclusionary rule is to deter further Fourth Amendment violations. In situations where there's no willful misconduct or no bad faith whatsoever on the part of the officer, it doesn't appear that any suppression is going to...
Well, getting to that point, didn't these officers know there was a law enforcement agency on the way to the scene? Didn't they know that?
That was part of the
order. And didn't they arrive seconds after the officers took this upon themselves to start it?
I don't know if it was seconds or the transcript was indicated 5 minutes or so. But the thing is, we're talking 315 on Lane Avenue.
Well, he was there.
Sorry, go ahead.
We have a conflict of who's going to talk.
Apologize.
Right? They were certainly there before the test was given because they said, well, go ahead and do it. You know, you need the practice. Didn't they?
That's correct.
Well, we can...
I'm sorry. The agents waited until the officer arrived there to even conduct any drunk driving type of investigation.
So they knew he was on the way. So the emergency that you talk of, that they had to stop this man in an emergency situation, really didn't exist.
Well, I don't know that you can take this entirely out of context as far as where it happened. These kids were heading to OSU campus on a Friday night, down Lane Avenue. I think that it was eminently reasonable for these officers to say, we want to detain him before he runs into this gauntlet of OSU campus when he's driving very hazardously on 315.
Had the automobile hit anyone before this?
No, they didn't actually strike anyone.
They didn't hit any pedestrian, or it didn't hit any car?
I don't know that there would be an opportunity to hit a pedestrian.
Or go off the road?
They stopped at the red light at the end of the ring.
Didn't go off the road or anything, right?
No, they didn't go off the road. Other vehicles did move over to a window.
It did. It did give some indication that they were crossing lanes and going faster than the vehicle should be going. That's about what they observed, right?
I think it would. They were going faster than the vehicle should be going, in excess of probably 35 miles an hour over the first day speed limit in that area, and nearly caused a couple of other accidents. The liquor control investigators indicated that that other people were leaving the roadway and that other people were braking rapidly in order to avoid being hit by the defendant.
Okay.
My time is up. We have a few minutes for lunch.
Thank you, Ms. Keltner. Mr. Manello.
Mm-hmm.
Members of the court, good morning. My name is Christopher Manello. I'm counsel for Avenue Andrassi. I came here this morning with the previous counsel, Timothy Huey. He and I had planned to divide the oral arguments in this case. We were going to ask the court committee to do that, and I understand that that's something that needed to be done in advance. So I will try to carry out Mr. Huey. I don't know if anybody can speak to Huey, but I'll do my best. The issue before the court is whether the actions of these liquor agents were reasonable with the context of the court. The follow-up to that, and what follows from the decision of that issue, is does this court wish to create a new type of traffic police, people in unmarked cars, out of uniform, without proper training, agents of the state, enforcing traffic laws? I think clearly the answer the first issue is the actions of these agents outside of their statutory authority is unreasonable in the context of the court.
Counsel, what if it had just been a couple of citizens who were what appears to be horribly irresponsible and dangerous driving, and
especially today,
pulls up,
especially today,
the environment is there's people down at a stoplight and goes up.
You mean to tell me if I'm stopped at a red light, take these two guys to affect this guy?
Well,
some of those guys which me bad. I'm supposed to stand here so we
have
I'm supposed to stop with them.
I want you out of the car.
Bullshit. It's too easy to get a fake badge.
Get the person out of the car.
My first
in the meantime,
I'm about to be robbed.
Manages to
that's
order an officer on the cell phone and manages to detain the person until the officer gets there and reports. This is the person I saw driving this car. The officer steps in and that's
stupid.
Is that a violation of the constitutional rights that would require suppression?
No, in the difference in your example, and one we have before the court is very, very important. Those two individuals are not agents of the state. They're private citizens. They're committing possibly a crime, because it would be a misdemeanor, not a felony, so therefore there's no authority for them to make any kind of detention. But
maybe a good crime.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But maybe a good crime.
It's possible. I mean, you can debate the merits of whether that's is it wiser to jeopardize possibly, you know, motorists with someone who may be under the influence, or to create an emergency situation where someone ends up getting shot, or, for example, engages in a high-speed chase down through the campus area in an unmarked car. You know, police officers...
So the fact that they are state employees and have some cloak of law enforcement powers in a niche area makes it different than if a citizen does.
Exactly. They have authority and they have a usefulness of that authority. They have a badge, they have a gun. And, you know, ironically in this case, they couldn't help themselves. The first words out of their mouths were, "We are police officers." That's the record. That's what these agents said. They didn't say we're liquor agents. They said we're police officers.
But you can't, I mean, you can't have a Fourth Amendment violation without state action. I mean, you, in order to say this is unconstitutional, you need the state action, don't you?
Certainly, Your Honor. And clearly we have that here. We have agents of the state doing something so far beyond their authority, it's not even close.
Well, I didn't know if Justice Pfeiffer was finished.
Yeah.
You finished well. When you say it's not even close, in the face of the statute that everybody's citing with assumptions, I mean, the trial court makes an assumption, and it's unclear to me the basis for that assumption, except for analysis purposes, the court said, I don't even need to get to that, I'm going the other way. But how can you say it's not even close in light of 5502.61b?
Well, and your question, this is directed toward the assistance provision.
Sure.
I think the only sensible reading of that has to be that the assistance in question has to be at the request of an authorized police officer.
And then we have, I guess as part of the record, we do have the testimony, I gather it's undisputed testimony, that having called in to this network, these officers were requested to detain.
I think...
By the dispatcher, whoever, we don't know, I guess, the record, the problem with the record, I suppose, is that we don't know if that's an officer, although, I don't know, isn't that always an officer that's a dispatcher?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah.
With regard to the identity of that person, there was objections to that testimony that was raised, that was the son of the bear that I raised in the Court of Appeals. But the answer to your question, I believe that this court should make it clear that the person assisted is right, that person requesting the assistance is the person assisted.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's not a radio dispatcher who says, do this or do that.
But what's the, I get your distinction, but I'm not sure the rationale for that distinction. It, as among officers, for instance,
right,
as among police officers, we would have the same sort of request for assistance by a dispatcher on the radio. So what's the point of the rationale for that distinction, that it has to be in person?
The distinction is there's a qualified police officer on the scene who's made a judgment.
Uh-huh.
I require assistance for whatever reason. I have seen the situation, I've evaluated it, I'm trained, and I require assistance. You don't have a dispatcher, Your Honor, who is getting the information from the agents. In other words, the dispatcher's full basis to do anything came from the agents. It came from the people who had no authority to do anything.
And that information, of course, it's not shown that it's false. I mean, erratic and very high speed driving is, you know, was the report. That not having been shown to be, you know, how do you color that?
If this court reads the assistance provision to allow a dispatcher to authorize liquor agents to assist, then we have statewide traffic.
In an emergency, I suppose, could be the limitation there, since that's part of the statute that would authorize this assistance. It says, when asked or in an emergency.
Once again, the problem I have is the liquor agents are defining what is or is not the emergency. The people without authority. Let me give the court an example, if I may. What if an elevator inspector for the state of Ohio had seen the same thing?
Is there a statute that applies to elevator operators assisting?
There is.
Because in this case, of course, liquor agents might be distinguishable from elevator operators in that they are defined as peace officers for some purposes.
For some purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that the agents were not acting as peace officers at this particular time. They were clearly outside of their authority. And they should not be the person to make the decision on the scene. Is this an emergency or is it not?
If the police officer who arrived at the scene later had been in contact with the liquor agents by radio, does he have the authority to instruct the liquor agents to make the stop?
If the peace officer was fully informed,
if they were talking back and forth on the radio, not to the dispatcher, but if the agents were talking to that they had the ability to get on to the highway patrol's circuit, and they were talking with Officer So-and-so, who was 3 minutes away or whatever, and is on the way to the scene, and Officer So-and-so said, listen, if they're that bad, why don't you just go up and make the arrest? I'll be there in 2 minutes. Could he do that? So the assistance aspect of it is only applicable where the officer has visual contact with the action.
I would even suggest a more narrow definition, Your Honor. I would suggest that it has to be a situation where a peace officer is engaged in some activity where there is a true emergency going on, and he cannot handle that himself. There's no reason why, in your example, the peace officer couldn't do it himself. And I can't imagine a police officer suggesting someone in an unmarked car do anything. That's dangerous to all the other motorists.
Is there any activity that the car could have taken that would justify a stop by the liquor agents? Is there anything that would justify the liquor agents into stopping that car? Any activity by the car they had observed would give them authority on the scene to make the stop?
The only thing that would allow them to make that stop is if they had probable cause to believe that there was a violation of the liquor law. For example, if they had observed something.
How about the commission of a felony?
Well, if there was a commission of a felony, they would have
as ordinary citizen, right?
That's
correct.
Sure. Or a private citizen.
What if they were driving the wrong way down the freeway?
Is that
the wrong
lane? And your last question is, would they have
to
make a stop
now? Would these officers, the agency, be able to stop them on that? Even though they have a very strong suspicion that these folks are drunk and have proven driving fire accidents with vehicles, correct?
Well, Your Honor, if you're looking at it from the standpoint of how do we best protect the public, that clearly happened in this case. I mean, Mr. Drosky's driving was terminated. That's not an issue. His driving was terminated. The issue is, may the state prosecute him after his Fourth Amendment rights have been violated?
Yes, counsel, there were an underage drinking charge here?
There was.
Okay, and these agents had the right to enforce those laws?
They did.
And so, but do they have the authority to stop him? I mean, if they see it, what appears to obviously be someone under his age of 21, erratically driving, they can't stop, presuming that person is engaged in underage consumption of alcohol.
I would say that hypothetical, there will be probable cause to believe that a violation of Title 43 had occurred, and that would be within their enforcement powers. However, in this case, the record is clear, and we inquired of the agents, did you have any reason to suspect that the driver was underage? And the answer was no.
So what's the answer to that question? Negative. They have no basis for the stop.
Correct. He could not identify the driver at all.
Or if he had seen over 21 an open container, it stopped the
matter. And I'm assuming that's a violation that's contained within Title 43. I believe it is.
I guess I'm still wondering why we don't. Still, I wonder why we wouldn't send this case back for more evidence. I still don't understand the trial court's decision to say that .61 does not apply. I mean, the statute is written in the disjunctive, as you know. A liquor control investigator may render assistance to their local law enforcement officer at the officer's request or in an emergency. That doesn't even require the officer's request. If it's an emergency, the statute says the agents can do something. I think this is an awfully close question of the facts for us to write a principle of law where we don't really don't have a very good record, do we?
Well, and you find this case in the statute of Your Honor, because unfortunately the state of Ohio did not prosecute that issue. They accepted the trial court's decision as it is.
And the court of appeals said that there's sufficient evidence in the record to support that finding of the trial court, and perhaps we'll find it in the record, but what I've seen from counsel just doesn't convince me that isn't a real issue. And if somebody driving down 315 at 100 miles per hour, if that's true, causing cars to stop and braking and so forth, that could be considered to be an emergency, I think. Maybe it's in the eye of the beholder, but I would think that could be considered an emergency for purposes of statute. And I guess that's why I don't understand why the trial court did what it did, but perhaps the record shows something different.
What I hope this court does not do is create the potential for a greater emergency, which is high-speed chases.
Well, it's subjective. I agree. There has to be a limit on it. But for purposes of applying the statute, it seems to me that there is a situation of an emergency where the liquor control agents perhaps could do what they did, even though we think it's...
As counsel, I'm interested, if the light's on, but I'm interested in this delineation, that this gradation from citizen who has no state action up to one of the police officers. I mean, it's pretty obvious that these guys, I mean, they're blown out in arms and coughing. So, we get the picture on what the problem is with them. Let's change it to a fireman or a fireman who's driving as a paramedic, driving an ambulance, sees this, comes up, doesn't offer any pretense that I'm a police officer. I'm a fireman. You know, I've got the fire truck right here. But I save people's lives, and I'm going to try and save your life and everybody else's. Get out of the car until this officer that I call gets here. Even though they're a state employee, is that, which side of the line is that fall?
That is the side of the line where an agent of the state is presenting the authority of the state to assist obvious that the authority of the state is involved, and...
Okay, I'm suggesting an example. A person is, other than the fact that they have on a uniform, they're not really doing it because they're doing it just as a citizen. They're not trying to throw around the authority of the state. That's not this case, I realize.
I don't think that's what the state needs. I don't think the state needs every state employee to become an enforcer of traffic laws. I think that would be a horrible result. And I hope that that's not the result in this case. My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Ms. Conner, you've used your time, if you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. In upside of the U.S. Supreme Court cases, it is a violation of the statute that has been considered and that is not dispositive. And overall, it is the analysis of whether the action was reasonable or not. And if you take that approach, as the lower court did, by just saying, assuming it's outside the statute, then you don't get into the massive discussions over what's the gradation of this person's affiliation with the state. And then you have the courts being able to be the ultimate arbiters of what is reasonable and what is unreasonable. And the examples given by the defense in courts in the land would probably say that would probably be unreasonable and is unconstitutional. I think it is an open matter for discussion.
Let me ask before you get away, 61D. The city did not apparently appeal the trial court's decision on that. Is that correct to the Court of Appeals?
The city did not believe that the trial court made any finding that 61D had been violated, or B is what that might be now, because that trial court made the assumption that even if a violation had occurred, it would not create a constitutional question and therefore wouldn't qualify for suppression. So there really wasn't a need to pursue that on appeal. The defense did raise claiming that factual findings had been made. The court below said no.
I would think the city would want 61D to apply. Wouldn't you want the Court of Appeals to say this was an emergency and these liquor control agents had the authority to walk up to the stopped car and do what they did because this was an emergency and the police were on the way?
It's actually on a secondary level, assuming that the court is willing to entertain suppression on a statutory violation. Our position has always been that the law does not automatically get you into a Fourth Amendment situation absent an unreasonable seizure. And once again, based on the U.S. Supreme Court cases, it's a factor to be considered, but then it's also a factor to be considered whether the officer's actions were willful, negligent, or just incredibly unreasonable, or whether they were made in good faith, and then lean on in other number of cases. So I don't know that, I think that the secondary argument, great, but at that point there's been no factual findings one way or the other, and I didn't think that they were essential.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion.